we've learned anything from these past couple of years, my fellow Americans, it's that personal medical freedom and liberty are in crisis. America Out Loud Pulse brings together the top experts in healthcare-related fields to keep you a beat ahead.
Hi, everyone. Today, we'll be spending some time with Dr. Mark McDonald, psychiatrist, discussing mass psychosis and how it came about during the COVID-19 crisis. We'll also be discussing his book, The United States of Fear, and his new fall online course, How Not to Be Fooled, which is open for registration at ipac-edu.org. We'll also chat with my friend and fellow scientist, Dr. Brian Hooker, about the Spelling to Communicate breakthrough and his personal experience with the program with his nonverbal son, Stephen. Finally, we'll do a victory lap with Bernadette Pager on bills that became law in Tennessee, allowing patients to acquire ivermectin over the counter, and chat about the course we're co-teaching this summer online called Medical Freedom, Informed Consent, and Human Rights. I'm your host, Dr. James Lyons Weiler of IPAC and IPAC-EDU, defender of freedom in science and freedom of education. Now, before we begin, I want to encourage everyone to please check out Clout Hub funder Jeff Brain's Fund Freely campaign to defend freedom in America at fundfreely.com/go. There's a lot riding on the success of this particular campaign, including freedom in scientific research and freedom in education. Let's all defend freedom in America at fundfreely.com/go. That's fundfreely.com/go. Today, I'm super excited that we have Dr. Mark McDonald. He's a psychologist by trade and by training, but of late, he's really focused on the entire well-being, the mental well-being of everyone in the population. And, you know, I have a lot of respect for him. So welcome to Pulse.
Thank you. I appreciate having me on and speaking about what I've been doing the last few months and years.
Right on. So you've been a busy guy. Last November 2021, you published the book, United States of Fear, How America Fell Victim to a Mass Delusional Psychosis. That was the first I had heard that phrase. So why don't you tell people what is a mass delusional psychosis and why you felt that now was the time to write this book?
Well, a lot of people may have heard this, in my view, erroneously described as a mass formation psychosis by Dr. Robert Malone, who's been speaking around the country for the last 6 to 9 months, which really is a mishmash of several different ideas, one of which I generated a couple of years ago in the fall of 2020, which is mass delusion, meaning that people are all at once, all deciding en masse to lose their minds and start becoming irrational and making poor decisions. And that this is essentially based on fear. That this whole mass delusional psychosis and confusion about what's up, what's down, what's right, what's left, what is safe, what is unsafe, what is good, what is bad, is really at its core driven by a loss of rational thinking because people are just plain scared. Now, another man in Europe, Matthias Desmet, a psychologist, has written about this as well, and he calls it mass formation. Now, he uses the word formation as a synonym for psychosis. And unfortunately, Dr. Robert Malone sort of got his words confused because he's not actually a psychiatrist. He's a bench doctor. He does studies on mRNA and he's an authority on that, but he's certainly not an authority on psychology by any means. And he said on the Joe Rogan podcast last year that we're suffering from a mass formation psychosis. And what he meant was essentially what I've been saying for the last 2 years, which is that Americans are afraid, Americans are not thinking well, and they're making really, really bad decisions. And a lot of it is driven by fear. And that's really what the first book was about.
Okay, so you go into the nitty-gritty about the reasons why people are afraid these days or have been afraid. A lot of us have come out of that fear. I'm going to confess that, you know, hearing that the virus coming out of Wuhan had a 20% mortality in people that had diabetes scared the pants off of me. It's a very clear clinical message. Of course, I was skeptical. I kept an eye on it, but it did cause me to lose my mind a little bit. I jumped on the bandwagon of, okay, if you go to the gas pumps, you know, wipe it down, be a good citizen, you know, flatten the curve. We don't want to kill all the people with diabetes in the country. So as a victim of the fear mongering that came out of China, who absolutely doesn't care whether I'm feeling safe. Well, actually, they might have a motive to make sure I don't feel safe, right? But they don't really want, they're not the warm and fuzzy CCP. So what are some of the examples of the fear mongering, the messaging that people could immunize themselves against?
Well, I talked about the three lies back in 2020, and there's now, of course, thousands and thousands of them. But some of the basic fallacies that people were taught and essentially ordered to obey, and then, of course, began to believe erroneously, were, for example, that there's absolutely no way to treat this illness. We have no treatment. Now, this is on its face nonsensical. And if anyone had just thought and paused and took a breath and said, well, wait a minute. I mean, we have medicine, we have research, we have drugs, we have surgery, we have hospitals. We've got respiratory viral infections for time immemorial that have been crossing our paths, most of which are not life-threatening. Now, this one happens to be, but so is tuberculosis. And yet we do have treatments for tuberculosis, even if they're not always effective. But no, this one we don't. All we have to do and all we can do is simply stay home and pray. And then if we stop breathing, we go to the hospital and then we get put on an intubator and 50% of us will then pass away within 72 hours. Now, this, of course, is terrifying, but it's also absolutely absurd. It's ridiculous. And I'm not even getting into the debate about the drugs that work and don't work and whether they're harmful or not and the whole horse to warmer argument with ivermectin. I mean, just the basic concept, there is no way to treat this respiratory pathogen, makes no sense. That was one of the first that really terrified people. And the second, to get back to what you just said about 20% mortality rate in diabetics, was also this nonsense that every single person is equally at risk of dying from this disease, including infants, including five-year-olds, including healthy SWAT officers and Navy Corps members. They all have to get vaccinated. They all have to isolate. They all have to test because they're just as likely to die. That is terrifying. I mean, if you think that your baby that you're holding in your arms has just as much chance of catching this and dying as your grandmother, who is diabetic, who is older, who does have one lung because she's been smoking for 20 years and had surgery, of course you're going to be scared. This went on and on and on, day after day, month after month, and it's still going on. Just today, I walked past my office. I saw a woman enter the physical therapy suite with her other coworkers. There's still a sign out saying you have to wear a mask to go inside, even though we have zero evidence to date that masks do a darn thing to block this virus. And she takes out a tissue. Of course, she has a mask on. And she puts it on the door handle and she turns the door with the tissue. And then she kicks the door open with her foot and she tosses the tissue in the trash can without touching the handle, opens the door, goes inside and starts her day. Now, I understand maybe back in March of 2020, this sounds a little maybe neurotic, but I kind of get it. People are just trying to be safe. We're now in May of 2022. Does this make any sense at all? It's been more than 2 years, and yet it's still there. The fear addiction is present as always, and people are just as terrified and irrational as they were 2.5 years ago.
Okay, so it takes a special mind like yours to be able to say, wait a minute, you know, just look at the data. You see that the elderly are much more at risk. I mean, I saw that much. I wasn't fooled by that. This is patently obvious. But some of the things that really got me, Mark, were stories about a family member that was caught on a bridge between going one way or the other, and the authorities who were going to get him one way, or he had to go to his family the other way. So he committed suicide so he didn't, you know, infect his family. And then, of course, we had the visuals, the signaling of the visuals of loved ones outside of nursing homes, you know, and just tell us, break it down for us a little bit, how they can get into your head with emotive and affective influences on your emotion that are not directly related to the topic, you know, that can move your heart and open up your heart, and then they slam you with something. You know, tell us how they... People can manipulate each other this way too. Why don't you talk about that for a minute?
Well, in my first book, United States of Fear, I outlined three specific forces that I believe have been acting in a collusionary fashion to scare us. And one of them are politicians. And we see that because of all of these ridiculous measures and shutdowns and lockdowns and quarantines that have been passed, which just inherently are terrifying. The other, of course, is large corporations. These corporations have done things like ban the fulfillment of legal prescriptions like ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, Walmart, Rite Aid, Walgreens. They've all done this. And then the third one, which is the one that you're alluding to, is really media. The media have had an enormous influence on stoking fear and maintaining it in the last few years, partly because they already had an open playing field. I mean, they went on the field with everyone carrying around phones down to age 3 or 4 in their pocket, which has automatic feeds and pushes, Yahoo News, Apple News. I mean, most of people in this country don't really read newspapers anymore. They barely even watch TV. They just watch stuff on their devices. And it's all being controlled by 2 or 3 individuals. There is not a broad competitive market for truth in the media currently. There is no market. I would even say that we're almost in a Soviet-style Pravda right now, where there is a small elite of a committee that actually decides what we hear, what we see. And they are not really on board with truth being the primary driving force. They are on board with control, compliance, fulfilling their own interests, the interests of their constituents, which are perhaps their shareholders, their employees, their political allies, their corporate friends. So a lot of what you just mentioned, these stories, these illustrations of bodies being piled up outside and stretchers and people being locked away in nursing homes to die, a lot of the stories that we heard actually turned out to be false. And if you look back over the last couple of years, most of those stories were actually inaccurate. And a lot of them were actually promoted by individuals who had political agendas. Just recently, for example, there was a woman who calls herself a doctor who has been pushing for remasking of children and for forced so-called vaccines in children under age 5 in order to save their lives. And she has a white coat on. She calls herself Dr. So-and-so. She says, "I'm just disgusted. I'm just disgusted by all of the callousness towards the lives of these children, these anti-vaxxers, these anti-maskers." Fortunately, within 24 hours of her massive, massive Twitter announcement that went all over the internet, somebody did a little bit of research and found photographic evidence that she's actually a paid employee of Pfizer. And there are pictures of her at Pfizer fundraisers hugging the executives on the stage. Now, we didn't know this 2.5 years ago. We suspected it, some of us that are more cynical and suspicious, but we didn't know the depths of the collusion of media and corporations and politics. Now we do. Now we're armed. Forewarned is forearmed. And I think we're in a better position to call it out. We have to be very, very suspicious of what we're told because most of it is not actually honest or truthful.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark. So one of the exercises that I've taken on that I found really helpful is when I see messaging from the government about public programs, whether it's public health or other, I always ask myself, if I was in a relationship with someone, whether it's a male-female relationship or a parent-child relationship, either way, and the messaging came to me from someone who said that they loved me, would that be appropriate? Right. And so obviously our government is highly paternalistic. They're practicing the infantilization of adults, while at the same time they're trying to build up teens to the point where they have the ability to make their own decisions without consulting their parents on vaccination. So they can provide informed consent. Well, it's not really informed consent, is it? So they can consent to vaccination without telling their parents about it. So I'm really interested, Mark, and you're such a good educator, such a good communicator about this kind of thing. What do we call it when someone manipulates you using fear in a personal relationship to get you to behave the way that they want?
A lot of people have used terminology, which is, I don't think entirely accurate, but I think it helps to illustrate the problem from different facets, such as identification with the abuser, Munchausen's by proxy, Stockholm syndrome, a lot of different terminologies that have been defined and explained over the last 30, 40 years through psychological histories. I think this is a somewhat hybrid case. And all of what you just said, I believe, is accurate. There is, in fact, an infantilization. There is a sort of father figuring by the American citizenry of the government, and actually even honestly of corporations and media, although I think the government is really the better father figure. And I think that there is an inherent weakness, as you said, when somebody is in a relationship with someone that they think loves them, and let's say they're being abused, often asking the question, theoretically, if this person loved me, would he be abusing me? It's not a sufficient question to ask, even though it should be in terms of your intellect, because there's an emotional tie to someone that says he loves you, despite the fact that he's abusing you, that leads you to want to believe that whatever the abuse is that he's incurring, that you're incurring, is actually helpful. And the old adage, the old example really is of the wife beater, the woman who's married to an alcoholic wife beater. And every time he beats her, afterwards, he says, but I really love you and you did deserve that. And she says, you're right, I did. And I know I'm going to be better. And so will you. And then they make up and then he does it again and again and again. So if the government does this to you and they keep locking you away, taking away your liberty, ruining your income, taking away your autonomy to make decisions for your child, forcing you to stay in a drug-induced haze because that's all you can do with beer and alcohol, and you say, I'm miserable, I'm unhappy. And then the government comes and says, but I'm doing this for your own good because I love you, because I'm here to protect you. I know it hurts, but the alternative would have been far worse. You would have been dead the moment you walked out that door and went to work. And you would have killed everyone around you. Oh my God, you're right. I'll keep on it. I'll keep on it, Daddy. I know you love me. It sounds silly, but I think this is somewhat of an unconscious mindset that has been ensconced in the American people. And the reason for it and why I explain in my book, there's a lot of cultural antecedents, psychological antecedents, but in a nutshell, it has to do with we as Americans becoming less and less independent, meaning focusing on our spouses, our children, our communities, our schools, our civic organizations, our churches, and more dependent on a higher power, which is not God, but which is the federal government. That is a distillation, really, of much of what I've been talking about the last couple of years.
Right. So they certainly did hack into our brain. And I've also discussed, and I think you have too, of the fine art of gaslighting, which Fauci is apparently extremely good at. So like you said, ensconcing you in fear first and then telling you, okay, the way out of this conundrum, you know, the way that you can save yourself is plan A. And then the very next day, actually, no, it was plan B. And then the next day, no, it's plan A. You go back and forth. And so the people that have a weakened constitution, they just give up and they say, it must be me. I didn't science well enough in school. Just tell me what to do. I give up. It's got to be me. I don't know what the heck they're talking about. Just somebody tell me what to do. And then it's not really a reliance on authority. It's kind of like, throw me a lifeline. Authority, you must know what you're talking about. And it's got to be me. So I see that hat playing here as well.
So true.
So we have just a few minutes left here. And I want to talk about IPAC EDU and the course that you put together, if you don't mind. So in the fall, you'll be teaching the fantastic course with a very straightforward title, How Not to Be Fooled. So what's your approach to the teaching the course, and what are people going to learn? What are the topics you're going to cover? And it's online, it's going to be live, it's going to be fantastic. So tell people about the IPAC EDU course you're going to teach.
So this is not going to be a medical discourse on the varying debates about pandemic response. It's not going to be a political diatribe about right versus left, at least not in the contemporary sense of Republican, Democrat. It's not going to be about me trying to tell people what to do, or certainly not what to think. In fact, that's kind of the reason why I'm doing the course, is to help explain to people that even if you like me, even if you accept what I'm saying, even if you agree with me, that's really irrelevant. What is relevant is that you learn how to think yourself. And you learn how to critique, and you learn how to say, wait a minute, you said this, then you said that. I don't understand. That's different. Can you explain that? Can you justify your opinion? If I can't do that, then you've got me. Then I've got to actually alter my view and alter my opinion. I've had a lot of people tell me over the last 2 years, Dr. McDonald, these are my patients most of the time, you've said so much, you've written so much, but I'm listening to so many people and they're all saying different things. And you're in the minority. So I don't know what to do. I don't know who to believe. How do I know who to trust and who to believe? Now, I could then produce all this evidence to show why my opinion is correct, why I'm better than they are, and why I'm right, they're wrong. But usually what I do is I answer it this way. And I say to them, well, just do this. Go back and look at what you were told in the last 2 years. Look at the source and see if it's been borne out to be correct. And if not, don't trust that source. That's one example of a technique that I'll be teaching and explaining with examples in this course of how to think better. In other words, how do you think for yourself? How do you not allow other people to think for you? And I'll be bringing in examples from the 20th century, which is a motherload of disinformation, propaganda, and rightthink, from communist China to Cambodia, certainly North Korea, Soviet Union, Pravda. And I'm also going to be illustrating that with contemporary examples of where I believe we sort of lost our way. Good example of that would be the whole gender pronoun debate, the transgender issues that come up about basic biological sex, people starting to believe things that are phenomenally just not possible. I am not going to in any way try to actively change minds. I am going to put some challenging topics and questions on the table, and I'm going to ask that people do their homework mentally and intellectually and challenge themselves to go back and see if what they've thought and what they've believed actually makes sense within a rational context over the last couple of years. And hopefully in the future, be able to apply that to newer problems, because we are not in a pandemic forever. We are now in a Ukraine pandemic. Pretty soon it'll be a financial crisis, maybe an environmental one. We need to have these tools in order to think for ourselves and in order to not be fooled in the future.
I love it. I love it. The vision that comes to mind is an overladen boat, and the government's telling us all to run to the right side of the boat, and then they tell us to run to the left side of the boat, and you know, there has to be a sufficient number of people that stand still to keep that boat going in the right trajectory. So the course will be offered through ipak-edu.org, ipak-edu.org, the title of the course, is How Not to Be Fooled. The instructor is Dr. Mark McDonald. It's been a pleasure and an honor to have you here. At some point in time, Dr. McDonald, I'm going to have you back. We're going to talk about the biological basis of the gender issue in some people, and how there is a biological basis for some types of problems with gender identification. And I'm going to challenge you on the notion of endocrine disrupting chemicals in the environment with potential mechanisms that we don't fully understand. However, as you said, basic biology, you're born a male, you're a male, you're born a female, you're a female, until the public schools tell you that you have to choose. And it's not coming out of anything that's coming from you, right? That's kind of what you're talking about, right?
I am. And I'm trying to make a distinguishing point between actual science and biology and the intrusion of politics and cultural programming into that, which is a soiling of the water so that we can no longer detect, say, estrogen influences on cancer and breast augmentation and the lack of testosterone, which is due to all sorts of environmental influences, which is a real issue and needs to be addressed. That is a very, very different subject than somebody announcing that from now until the end of time, we're going to revamp our language and start instituting words like they and sure and shall to replace biological sex. Very, very interesting topic.
It is very important and topical topic. We'll have you back and talk about it. Dr. Mark McDonald, thank you so much for your time. You're a sage, you're a gentleman scholar, you're in it for the right reasons. Kids that are committing suicide after the surgery when they have decided, you know what, that was not who I really thought that I was. I don't know why I did that to myself. Blessings on your head. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Mark McDonald, author of The United States of Fear and IPAC EDU faculty for the course How Not to Be Fooled. Check it out at ipak-edu.org. That's ipak-edu.org.
While many things we hear are lies, we know one thing is true. Viruses exist and people get sick. Look, there's no guaranteed way to keep from getting sick, but there is a way to reduce your chances. Cofix RX, the original povidone iodine-based antiviral nasal spray that you hear Dr. McCullough talking about, provides an additional, invisible layer of protection from colds, flu, coronaviruses, and more. Click the banner ad on AmericaOutloud.com and use promo code OUTLOUD for 20% off. Stay protected with Cofix RX.
As Americans, we seek to form a more perfect union. To paraphrase Abraham Lincoln, we are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And God willing, we shall not perish from the earth. AmericaOutloud.com. Liberty and justice for all.
Here on America Out Loud, we emphasize optimal health, and air is the most essential element for life. The average person inhales over 35 pounds of air every day. Yet we seldom think about how to rid the air of pathogens swiftly and safely when we need to. The Genesis Fogger Plus HOCL is the only way to quickly and naturally restore air to its optimal condition. Visit genesisfogger.com/outloud for a free ebook on everything you need to know about HOCL and receive a 15% discount on the Genesis Fogger with promo code OUTLOUD. With Genesis, you'll be ready for what's next.
You may know people with autism. You may know people that don't speak, that don't have autism. These are called nonverbal individuals. And as we have come to better learn and understand about what their capabilities are and what their experience is like, we have had some stunning emergences. On my own podcast, Unbreaking Science, I interviewed J.B. Handley and his son, Jamie, and I'll be talking about that in this segment for a little bit. But in this segment, I wanted to bring on my friend and colleague, Brian Hooker. Dr. Brian Hooker, how are you today?
I am just super. Thank you, Dr. Lyons-Weiler, for having me. It is so wonderful to be able to talk on your show, and my hat's off to you, all the wonderful things you're doing. You're quite a dynamo.
Well, thank you very much. So apraxia is the inability to speak, and individuals who can't speak prefer to be called nonverbal. And nonverbal persons may or may not have autism. Now, most of you will recognize Dr. Brian Hooker as the man who brought forward the information from William Thompson, hours and hours of recordings and transcripts, where William Thompson did say a number of stunning things, not the least of which is that for the on-time MMR versus delayed MMR study published by his colleagues, Frank DiStefano et al., that they actually altered the study design until the data, try to make the data fit their expectations on whether or not on-time MMR caused autism or not. And they also reduced the statistical power of that study by dropping children who didn't have valid Georgia birth certificates. But that's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about Brian Hooker, who is a dad. So as a dad with his son, Stephen, I've seen Brian talk about Stephen to me personally, and his eyes always light up. He's always got a smile. He refers to him as his beautiful boy. But Stephen has now grown into a handsome and rigorous young man. And Brian has recently had the beautiful experience of actually getting to meet his son through communication. Now, Stephen was nonverbal for most of his life. He's still nonverbal in terms of speaking, but Stephen can now communicate with the rest of the world through an amazing development called Point to Communicate. And when I interviewed JB Handley and his son, Jamie, there was a moment in that video that has to be the most watched and slowed down part of that video, where Jamie decided to join the interview. And after sitting there, kind of fidgeting, looking around, not really engaging, kind of disconnected, his dad brought over his board and he asked Jamie, "Hey, do you want to say something?" And he did. And right at that moment, he looked down at the keyboard, staring at the keyboard, finding the letter, and then looking up at the screen to make sure that the letter that he selected was actually represented on the screen. Now, that to me should silence any critic. This technology was new. When it first came out, people would say, "Oh, the parents are helping them. The parents are doing it. It's just wishful thinking. These people are delusional." All right. So I brought Brian Hooker, dad, on to talk about his experience. Tell us about Stephen and when Stephen was born, and start with that, if you don't mind.
No problem. This is my pleasure. Stephen is such a light. He's now 24 years old. He was born in 1998. He crashed and burned really early. He regressed into autism starting at 15 months of age. And then by 18 months, he had lost all of his language, lost all of his eye contact. And he received a diagnosis of full-blown autism from his pediatrician. And then we saw a developmental pediatrician that confirmed that diagnosis and have worked with him, you know, diligently since that period of time. We worked using a modality called Sunrise that it's a little bit different. You know, it's not as rigorous as ABA. It's a lot more child-centric. People who have not heard about Sunrise would probably recognize something very similar to that called Floor Time. What it's done is it shaped my son's personality to a place where he's such a kind soul. He's always been really wonderfully kind. He's never been, you know, one of these children that gets violent or abusive. And, you know, he's a big kid. He's 5'9", weighs 180 pounds. And so, you know, if he wanted to slam his weight around, he really could. But he is so gentle. He is so kind. He is so kind in public. And he does really work hard at regulating himself. His real problem is dyspraxia. And that is, he cannot tell his body what to do. And what he wants his body to do is not necessarily what will come out with his body. And you see these children, and especially my son, if his anxiety gets high, then he is in a state of fight or flight. And so when he's in a state of fight or flight, then that flight mechanism really does work out and it's difficult for him to sit still. So we've really have met him where he is. And now by Spelling to Communicate, it is just opened up. You know, we've been doing this for exactly a year, you know, not a long time, but it has so opened up his world and unlocked, you know, so many things. For so many years, I've just wanted to know, what's in your thoughts? You know, what are you thinking right now? If you could put your thoughts into words, what would that be? So now we've had the opportunity to do that.
So before the show, a couple of days ago, actually, Brian, you told me that you had an expectation about what Stephen's thoughts, what he tended to gravitate towards thinking about and what he'd like to think about in his, in, during his time. And you were surprised that he actually has a distinct line of thought that is pretty amazing, actually. Why don't you tell us who you think Stephen is now that you've met him through Spelling to Communicate?
My son is extremely eloquent, and he is an eloquent speaker. He doesn't choose his words carelessly. He chooses his words wisely. I know, you know, when you're spelling to communicate, you know, if I put myself in that position, then you're not getting as many opportunities to say words. You know, it can be a slow, cumbersome process. So my son is very wise, and he chooses his words wisely, you know, in terms of what he wants to communicate and what he needs to communicate. And, you know, we've seen him communicate at times where he's really at peace. We've seen him communicate at times where he's really, really frustrated and especially dysregulated with his body. And so having those bits and pieces, my son's a rock star. He is just a total genius with the way he communicates. And to see him, you know, put things together in complete sentences, you know, not just, oh, what do you want to eat, Steve? Fries. You know, it's not like that. It's not, you know, I think that there's an impression that you get sort of this basic communication, but no, you unlock the entire world. And, you know, I'm very familiar with J.B. Handley and Jamie's story. And, you know, you hear what these children produce, these now adults produce. It is, you're talking to an individual who, because of dyspraxia and because of apraxia, you know, is locked away. But when you find the key to unlock that door, then what you see is so completely different than what any of us have expected.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned earlier that you thought he was a scientist, but that he's more of a reflective philosopher. And tell me about that.
Well, he tends to gravitate towards, you know, things that are more artistic in nature. My son is very visual. He is, you know, when he speaks, it's, I'll never forget, you know, his first phrases that he spoke. And this was in a session. We were actually working with his practitioner, Don Marie Gavin, who, you know, has an office in Oceanside, California. And this was his first experiment with open communication. So she brings down the big 26 letter board, asks him, you know, how are you feeling right now? You know, how are you feeling? And he was performing actually pretty well with his assignments and, you know, with oral comprehension in his lessons. And his first open communication wasn't like, oh, I'm good or cool or fantastic. His first open communication was really joyful. You know, I'll never forget that. My wife and I were crying. It was so absolutely amazing. And then later on in the day, she asked him what he felt about Spelling to Communicate. And he spelled out such a gift. And so for Christmas this year, my wife got me personalized water bottles that look something like this, but I keep mine. And the personalized water bottles say really joyful and such a gift. So I can remember, you know, his first open communication whenever I use them. You know, they're so precious to me. I don't bring them to school because I knock this one around. But that was not what was expected. And what happened afterwards was just as significant. His self-esteem and his self-confidence went through the roof. He was just beaming. He was so happy. You know, I took him to the restroom afterwards, and he just looked in the mirror, you know, with such admiration, like, wow, you know, this is the real me. And so that to me is money. It is so, you know, because it begets more, you know, he gains the confidence. He wants to spell more. It's easier for him to sit in his sessions and spell more. And then that begets more success. And it, you know, it's just like this positive feedback loop. And, you know, that's what he's been doing ever since.
That's so beautiful. So I'm going to ask you a few questions. What is, other than what you just told me, what is the most profound thing that Stephen has informed the world about in his communications?
Well, he has informed the world that you know, to me, he told me he didn't like my music.
Typical teenager.
Poor guy. You know, he's been listening to a, you know, sort of a consistent diet of 80s music. And he, you know, he hasn't had much of a choice. He doesn't have much of a choice in things. And so, you know, he has let me know that he doesn't necessarily like his music. And at one point, you know, at a point of his greatest frustration, and this was really telling. He spelled out, I can't learn to control my body. And that was really, really a breakthrough, because it was him self-diagnosing, like, okay, when you're thinking, you know, when you are diagnosing yourself, what is this like, you know? And this has been years of taking him to doctors, specialists, practitioners, occupational therapists, physical therapists, and then just guessing and then hoping that we were right. But for him to say, I can't learn to control my body, then we knew, okay, he wants to do things that he just can't get his body to do. And that was after a session that was particularly challenging, where he couldn't sit still. He was walking around the room. He was pacing. We had asked him to sit down in the chair, to spell from the chair. Don Marie, his practitioner, then started working with him while he was standing, which was wonderful. She met him where he was. You know, that's what he spelled. That was his first complete sentence, was, I can't learn to control my body. It was so wonderful, because now we know, and we knew before, but now we know implicitly, we need to work with dyspraxia. We need to work with getting his eyes and his hands and his body all in the same place. So we're actually doing a therapy intensive in August that Transcending Apraxia is sponsoring, that is specifically for dyspraxic kids. And again, as soon as he was able to communicate that, you know, we wanted to validate him and validate what you said is extremely important to us. And what you said was what we wanted to work on. And then, you know, at that point, he had so much confidence and there was so much feedback that the rest of the sessions, and we did several sessions that day, he was able to sit in his chair. He was able to attend. He was able to do things. And it just sort of like pushed him over the edge. And, you know, we had just a wonderful, successful time.
What kind of music does Stephen like?
I was a marching band geek, a big marching band geek, so much so that I joined a professional drum and bugle corps, you know, right outside of high school, and I toured around for a summer and I did that. And so we have all these DVDs of the world championships of drum corps. And he, you know, it's very intricate. It's very, you know, choreographed to the max. So much better than, you know, in the old days, you know, back when we had to shoo the dinosaurs off the field to do our show. But he loves that music. He loves drum corps music. And we actually have CDs that we listen to in the car. We have recordings on my phone. And because it's so drum heavy and it's so bass heavy, he really, really enjoys that music. He really, really likes that. And then he listens to, we listen to a lot of church worship music. My son is very spiritual. He's been spiritual and really, really spiritually intuitive. And so we listen to a lot of church worship music. And that is really, really calming for him. And so, you know, but anything with the 80s, nah, he's not interested.
Well, you're an amazing dad, an incredible person all the way around. I am so proud to know you and so proud to call you my friend and colleague. In the last couple of minutes that we have here, let's talk about the Transcending Apraxia program. People from around the country are going to hear this as we go out on America Out Loud Pulse. So Dawn Marie Gavin in Oceanside, California, transcendingapraxia.com. Just tell the people, you know, how do people work with Dawn Marie, and what can they expect in terms of the business transactions?
Well, it's actually very reasonable. A session will last an hour, and we do intensives where we'll do 2 days in a row, and we'll do two sessions per day. We have done 3 days in a row, kind of maxed out, but 2 days in a row. And so we fly to LAX, we drive down to San Diego. It just works out easier that way. There's a direct flight from where I live in Reading. And then she works with Steve. She works with my wife and I. And then we come home and then we do daily spelling lessons with him. And then we have exercises that really promote sort of whole body praxis and hand-eye coordination. So, you know, we'll do, you know, maybe one or two spelling lessons a day and duration, maybe 30 to 40 minutes, you know, as much as he can handle. And then you can send videos. You can actually video yourself doing a lesson. So you can do a video consult. She actually does consults over Zoom, you know, with parents and practitioners. And you know, every 3 or 4 months, then we fly down and we get a checkup. And we do additional lessons, and she will encourage us to, you know, move further. Like, okay, you need to, you know, stop here, or you need to focus on the 26 letter board. And you know, it was exciting to graduate to the 26 letter board. That was really, really exciting. And we knew that Steve was ready for it. And you know, she coached us through open communication, because a lot of times it can be really clumsy at first. And so, you know, he may spell himself into a corner where you don't know what he doesn't know how to get out of that corner, and you don't know what he's actually trying to communicate. So the sessions are vital. If you are local, she works with children on a weekly basis. You know, those individuals that can, you know, drive from San Diego or live there locally in North San Diego County, she will do sessions with them directly. But mostly it's intensives, you know, where people come into town. And then ultimately, like the transition for us then will go from a 26 letter board then to a keyboard. And that's where, you know, JB and Jamie are. And, you know, Jamie can communicate now with a computer. And she has so many communicators now that they have chat groups online. Individuals that have graduated from college, they have a program with a college. It's called MiraCosta College there in Oceanside. Spellers will go and they regulate themselves so they can sit through lectures, and they have accommodation so they can spell out their lessons, they can take their tests. Even her own son, she's got two sons that are on the autism spectrum. One of them is now taking algebra and is solving quadratic equations. And she's like, I can't help him with his homework. I don't know quadratic equations. But, you know, they're just smart. She's unlocking these children and adults. It opens such a world for them. So look for it, look for Spellers on social media by JB Handley. He wrote a book about this. It was called Underestimated, and now he has a documentary coming out this fall called Spellers. It should be out and available for streaming this fall.
We will absolutely share that, information out as well. So Brian Hooker, thank you. You're a great dad, a great scientist, and a great American citizen. You know, I believe that the Transcending Apraxia team also trains practitioners in how to help kids. Is that right?
That is correct. And there are more and more practitioners. We have a practitioner now in the Bay Area that, you know, which is a little closer for us, that we can also use.
Great. Thank you. Well, our time's up. Brian, thank you for everything that you've done. Thank you so much. And I look forward to talking to you soon.
Trouble getting to sleep and staying asleep can be infuriating. Your mind races, you toss and turn, and the harder you try, the harder it is to drift off. And today's digital age makes it even harder. You're not alone with this struggle. Poor sleep affects over 70% of Americans. Even the Centers for Disease Control label insufficient sleep a public health epidemic. To take back your sleep, Healthy Cell has created REM Sleep, the only sleep supplement made to support all four stages of human sleep, with calming herbs, amino acids, and sleep hormone support, delivered in a patent-pending, pill-free, ultra-absorption microgel formula that tastes great. Fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deeply, and wake up refreshed.
with Healthy Cells REM Sleep. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
All right, for our third and final segment for today on America Out Loud Pulse, it is my great pleasure to introduce you to Bernadette Pager, my dear and close friend. She is the host of Informed Life Radio, and she's active in Tennessee and Washington on issues around scientific integrity and public health policy. It seems the universe has fated us to collide and intersect given our shared interests. And how are you today, dear?
I'm very good. Thank you.
So let's have some victory laps here in Tennessee. Tell the listeners, if you don't mind, about the recent victories that health freedom activists in Tennessee have had in securing the rights of citizens around issues of informed consent and medical choices.
Yeah, you bet. You know, it's pretty exciting. In all 50 states, really good bills get drafted, find sponsors, and dropped and enter committees, and there they usually die. And that's what happens in Washington State, where I'm still active. And this just shows the power of the vote. Really pay attention to who you're voting for so you get some medical freedom loving, supporting legislators in office. You don't have to agree on whether or not any particular medical approach is, you know, what you would choose. You just have to have people who will respect your right to choose. And that's what we have here in Tennessee. So there were three pieces of legislation that are pretty exciting. One says that for purposes of organ donation, you cannot discriminate either a donor or a recipient based solely on their COVID-19 vaccination status. Because, you know, as we know throughout the country, people have been removed from lists because of their refusal to get the shot. Here in Tennessee, you cannot discriminate based on that at all. So that was really good to see.
That's a huge win. You shouldn't be penalized for knowing more about the COVID-19 mRNA vaccination / biologics than your doctors. Exactly. Or your public health officials. You should be rewarded for that. Why is it a death sentence to know more about the risks and the lack of benefit? Or it's all risk. And so why in the world would you be penalized? You should be held up as an outstanding citizen who actually uses your public education in a wise and informed manner to make your medical choices. So, right. Congrats on that one.
Thank you. Yeah. And especially since if you actually follow all of the science on these products, you realize that the people who need heart transplants and liver transplants and kidney transplants are at the highest risk of having adverse reaction to the shots, and they don't need to be receiving that spike protein from the donor either. So, I mean, it's just absurd that the law was even needed, but I'm very proud of our state for getting it through.
There's this beautiful picture of you standing in front of a compounding pharmacy, I believe it is, with one of the most beautiful smiles I've ever seen on your face. And you look like a kid, the cat who ate the canary.
Yeah.
With apologies to all canary lovers everywhere. Bernadette, what did you do?
What did I do? I played a role. I was not the only person. I was part of an amazing team that got behind actually a couple of ivermectin bills to make it more accessible. And then it whittled down to one thanks to a wonderful senator here in Tennessee, Shane Reeves, who's also a pharmacist. He helped draft amendment language to give us a really good solid bill that passed into law that makes ivermectin available over the counter without a prescription after consultation with a pharmacist. So it's still dispensed in a very safe manner. There's something called a collaborative pharmacy agreement that has to be in place with a physician and the pharmacist, you know, a lot of things in place there, but it's very exciting so that individuals can now, for any reason, go in, have that consultation. It's going to take a little time.
That's fascinating. So you made a little history a couple of weeks ago, and this photograph captures that moment in history and medical freedom.
Yes.
Bernadette, what did you do?
Oh, I was the first one to purchase ivermectin over the counter in the United States from a pharmacist after my consultation.
Legally.
You know, legally. Yes. Yes. It was very good. It was a historic moment. And I've got to thank that wonderful pharmacist, the compounding lab, Dr. Denise Sibley in Tennessee, who was instrumental. I'm about 4.5 hours from the Capitol. She's about 5.5. And we would meet up and drive into Nashville together. But, you know, thank you to Dr. Robert Malone, Dr. Pierre Corey, Dr. Paul Merrick, Dr. Richard Urso, Dr. John Littell, and countless Tennessee doctors and nurses who did come to the legislature and just have great meetings and educate them on how doctor-patient relationship and how they had saved lives. In fact, Dr. Denise Sibley has treated more than 4,400 COVID patients for free using ivermectin and the FLCCC protocols to great success. So
Fantastic, Richard Urso and so on. Hey, so let's do this. Let's make it perfectly clear that yes, people bought ivermectin at pharmacies from pharmacists in the past, right? But you're
a prescription.
You're the first one to do it under this new arrangement, which is all you need is a consultation with your pharmacist, which basically makes it over the counter, which is, you know, a fascinating and inappropriate development for something that has such an amazing safety profile and such benefits, such health benefits for so many people. So congratulations and thank you on that, Bernadette.
You're welcome.
So, you know, this is the kind of person that I want educating me, right? I want Bernadette Pagers educating me if I don't know about medical, if I don't know about medical freedom, medical ethics, informed consent, and human rights. And so Bernadette put our heads together and we decided to put together a course with that title, Medical Ethics, Informed Consent, and Human Rights. And it's going to run this summer. There'll be 15 topics that we're going to review. This is an instructor-led live online discussion. So Bernadette, tell us about your vision for this course and what the students can expect to experience and what they should bring to the course.
What I'm excited about is at the ripe old age of almost 59, and having, you know, read some of these documents, say in my teens in social studies class, and maybe once or twice as an adult, to go back through them now. In the past, they have mostly been academic exercises because I never felt my medical freedom was threatened, my life was threatened. It was an exercise in trying to step in the shoes of other people who have been abused. But to go back now and read the language of some of these historic humanitarian documents, you feel them, you get them, you understand what the drafters were doing, and it's so much more meaningful. So I think that a lot of people will really today grasp the information and the importance of it in a way they had never have before because of their life experiences over the past couple of years.
When students come to this course, they should expect that they will leave the course being able to cite chapter and verse on official documents and other historical facts. So early on, there'll be, you know, a discussion on early individual rights in medicine, just the history of who's the first person that stood up and said, hey, wait a minute, maybe I should choose whether or not you, I don't know, attach a leech to me, or maybe maybe I should choose to be bled so much. Who knows? But we'll see what we can find in terms of early documented discussions on individual rights. And this is deep history. This is, you know, ancient Greece, the ancient Romans, and we'll see what we can find predating modern civilization. But then we're also going to look at the very sad and macabre topic of human subjects experimentation. And we're going to look at the Nuremberg rulings and the rights that are codified in that ruling. This is just in week three. The whole point of this is that all the students will read the material beforehand, right? And then it'll be an instructor-led discussion. So what you should bring to the course is your brain and, you know, your love of humanity, because you're going to run into some pretty dark stuff, but then you'll be able to say, hey, wait a minute, this is how society at that point in time decided, you know, this isn't appropriate. We need to change the way things are going.
Yeah, we're not going to tell students how to feel about the information. We're going to have discussions so that they can work through the language, think about it in terms of their own experiences and what's happening, you know, and in that way, discover for themselves the importance of these documents and what aspects are important to them. It'll be interesting to, you know, hear everybody's thoughts.
It will be. And we're going to go into the Helsinki documents. People might not even know what that is and why that's important. And we're early doctrine of informed consent. You know, it was really funny because in the buildup to the misinformation campaign in COVID-19, I read somewhere in mainstream press that the CDC was concerned over activists because the activists were talking about something called, quote, informed consent.
Yeah.
As if that's not a real thing, right? Yeah. It's like they think that they have a right to, quote, informed consent.
Yeah.
And so that tells me that the person that wrote that probably never heard that phrase before.
Yeah.
And it's very important that, we study and discuss the doctrine of informed consent in medicine in the United States. How in the world did it become codified? What can people cite? What resources are there online?
Yeah.
It published in the by the federal government, voted on by your congressmen or your ancestors, congressmen and senators, if you're young, right?
Yeah.
And also in medical research, what rights do you have to be protected from medical research in the United States?
And what is medical research? Because the federal government and the oversight agencies like you to believe that once they give the A-OK on a product and send it out there, that it is no longer research. And that could not be further from the truth. Because if you dig a little deeper, you get quotes from the FDA that says that most adverse reaction to any drug biological product is learned about in aftermarket reporting. So, you know, the research continues. It's continually experimental. And then we've got the difference between traditional pharmaceuticals and your biologics and your vaccines. And now we've got the genetic therapies and informed consent legally is being treated differently. How did that happen? And then we've got the clash between the marketing messages that do not provide the proper information for informed consent to happen, you know, at a population level. And then you just reliant upon the person who's about to inject you or dose you. And it's very challenging. Things have become very challenging. It's not cut and dry. So you really need to be informed yourself of your rights.
Right. And this course is not all about vaccines, people. So yes, there's going to be a whole reading on vaccine choice, but there's also going to be readings and discussions on your right to try and do not resuscitate orders. People going into hospital under COVID ended up with DNRs that the family really didn't know where they came from. Another topic that I wanted to put in here were special protections for pregnant women and children. That's codified in the U.S. Code of Federal Regulations. We're actually going to review the U.S. Code of Federal Regulations. You'll be able to cite those chapters and verse. We have privacy rights to review. What really happened? Did they suspend HIPAA during COVID? What is HIPAA? And now when it became clear that the vaccinated were coming down with so many cases of COVID, they wanted to say, no, we never suspended HIPAA. So we're actually going to look at the documents by which the HHS suspended your right to privacy and COVID and COVID-19 vaccines. What happens to executive powers during times of crisis? What happens to government powers during times of crisis? What is the actual law of the land state? And what are the constitutional infringements that we know about when someone says to you, I'm your doctor, I know better, you must do this to your body?
And your employer says that.
Yeah. Right. Well, we'll start with the doctors because even they have limitations. But if your employer says it or your school board says it, that's what they're. Yeah. So we're going to talk about that kind of coercion. We only have a couple of minutes left, but let's talk about the guest speakers that are coming in.
Okay.
We have three guest speakers that are going to join us with presentations and discussions. So the first one that comes to mind is
Mary.
Mary Holland. Absolutely. Mary Holland of Children's Health Defense. And the second one is.
Woody Moss.
Woody Moss, believe it or not, West Virginia, Woody Moss, his family calls him Woody Moss. He's an awesome guy. He's very well known for helping to codify the rules on taking any incentive product from corporations if you're in academia. And he's been all over informed consent and medical freedom issues.
Yes,
and,
for years.
Yeah, so we have these great guest speakers. Dr. Michael Gaeta wants to join us and he'll be there for some of the discussions.
Oh, he's got this great packet of stuff I love to refer to. Yeah, I love Dr. Gaeta.
Yeah, Dr. Michael Gaeta, he's one of our best. And so IPAC.edu, very quickly, IPAC-edu.org. Course is going to start June 15th, ladies and gentlemen, IPAC-edu.org. Go to IPAC-edu.org. Signing off for America Out Loud Pulse. Thank you, Bernadette. I'm going to have her on as a guest host. She's wonderful. You guys are going to love her. Thank you, Bernadette.